Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The writer Paul Auster has a new book with an interesting concept. It's a memoir of his life as experienced by his body. For example, not just how it felt politically to be a student at Columbia during the Vietnam War, but how it felt physically. And he wrote it in the second person, as in, "You are 10 years old and the midsummer air is warm, oppressively warm." The book is called Winter Journal, and Paul Auster joins me now. Thank you so much for coming on.
I'm delighted to be here.
Why would you write about yourself in the second person?
Well, it's an interesting question, a fundamental question. I feel that I'm writing about not just myself, but about everybody, because my life is not particularly interesting or exceptional. But I wanted to talk about what it feels like to be alive in your own skin. Now, the first person would have been too exclusionary, I think. It would have been saying, this is my narrative, and that's really not the intention of the book. Third person would have been too distant. And the second person seemed to be the happy medium where I could address myself as a stranger and engage in a kind of dialogue with myself.
I know you sometimes write about Zen and things like that. Were you trying to create an out-of-body experience where you're looking at yourself?
Not quite that. It's a kind of inner dialogue more than anything else.
And yet the narrator in a second-person memoir is still you, isn't it? Otherwise, who's addressing you as you?
Well, it's me. But I think it does something strange to the reader as well, to see all those second-person pronouns. Perhaps the reader feels as if it's about him or her as well.
I was just going to say that because it had that effect on me.
Yeah.
It made me think at each turn, oh— how am I experiencing a similar thing to what you might have gone through?
Right, because, I mean, I'm talking about all kinds of things in this book, and I should say that it is not a continuous narrative. What I think of the book as autobiographical fragments. It's little blocks of prose, some of them long, some of them quite short, composed more like a piece of music than an ordinary continuous narrative, so that little themes might be announced early and then they're picked up later. And it's not the story of my life so much as a literary work that uses my life as its subject to get to other things about what it is to be alive.
So about being a student at Columbia during the Vietnam War, you write that you had a feeling of wanting to be somewhere else. Why somewhere else?
Those years were very oppressive in the United States for those of us who were at that age in particular, I think. The Vietnam War was a suffocating presence in everyone's life, but particularly for undergraduate men who were all facing the draft. And the terrible thing about those years was if you were against the war, and I was very, very much against the war, and had made a decision that I was not going to enter the army, no matter what. So the two choices were leave the country and go into what felt at the time would be permanent exile, or go to jail. And it's not the happiest way to go through your undergraduate career. And I think the desire... I think when I wrote that, I was a sophomore, and I just wanted to get away from New York for a while.
So you moved to France?
Yes, briefly.
Why France?
There was a junior year abroad program that Columbia had, and so I signed up. But then, of course, I was a hot-headed boy at the time. I got into a dispute with the head of the program and quit. I just quit in the middle of the thing, and was no longer a student for a while. And then I was really exposing myself to all the things that I was most dreading in the world. But wiser heads prevailed and talked me into coming back, and they were so nice to me at Columbia. They allowed me to pick up the first semester at late October, early November. And so I didn't lose my student status.
And you weren't even Paul Auster then. You were just some kid.
Just some kid, some undergraduate kid.
Paul Auster's new memoir is called Winter Journal. And you came back during the Watergate hearings and describe your body as needing to get acclimated to America again. Can you describe that?
Well, after 3.5 years living abroad, I returned to a country that was in a crisis, the Watergate Nixon debacle. The food is different, the air is different, the buildings are different, even the grass seems different in Europe than in the United States. But I must say that by then I was very hungry to be back here because I missed English. I wanted to be in an English-speaking world again.
Because it was comfortable?
No, because I didn't, as a writer, and I was writing poetry then, I didn't want to lose contact with my own language. And I knew a lot of Americans in Paris, but still, I was speaking French half the time. And I wanted to be on buses and subways where I was overhearing conversations in American English.
You're a local kid from both sides of the Hudson, you might say. You grew up in Newark and South Orange, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were one of the earlier artists to move to Park Slope in 1981, pre-gentrification. How much are you aware of seeing the world through New York area eyes?
Well, I'd say I moved to Brooklyn. It was January 1980. So it's been a while, half my life. And my mother grew up in Brooklyn, was born and grew up in Brooklyn. My grandparents were moved to Manhattan in 1941 when my mother was 16. So I spent a good deal of my childhood in New York City, but I was living in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both. I'm both.
I remember seeing your movie Smoke in the 90s and being impressed that some of the story took place in New York City, but it was also set in Poughkeepsie. And I thought, what a refreshing, non-city-centric New York story. And I'm curious if being from both Jersey and the city gives you a regional way of seeing things.
I've never really thought about it. I must say that I think growing up in the New Jersey suburbs, up to about the age of 12, 11 or 12, was a kind of paradise. We were free. All my friends and I were unsupervised. We played our baseball games and all our football games with no adults around from 3 o'clock when school was out until 6 when dinner was served. I didn't have to go home. We roamed, we played, and it was just the most wonderful kind of childhood imaginable. About the age of 12, when you hit adolescence, these small towns become very suffocating, confining. And at that point, I wanted to get out. But I'm happy I had that bucolic early period.
Since it's a physical memoir, do Newark or South Orange have different sensory environments than Park Slope or Sunset Park or Manhattan?
Sure. Every place is different. There's no question about it. I've lived in, just to confine ourselves to Brooklyn, in three different neighborhoods over these years. I started out in Carroll Gardens, which was one experience, which I write about in the book. Then there's Cobble Hill, which is yet another, and Park Slope, the third, where I've been the longest, has a different atmosphere altogether from those other two places. Park Slope seems to me to be a kind of miniature Upper West Side with little buildings rather than big buildings, smaller density of traffic in the streets, but nevertheless a kind of heterogeneous spot where you see the entire world walking down the streets.
You've heard the Upper West Sider's life cycle, right?
No.
You live on the Upper West Side until you have your first kid, and then you move to Park Slope until you have your second kid when you move to Montclair.
That's very funny.
We have some people calling in to talk to you, so let's take a couple of calls for
okay.
Paul Auster, whose new memoir is called Winter Journal, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you've been a Paul Auster reader maybe for a long time and have something to tell him or ask him. Linda in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, Good morning, Brian and Mr. Oster. Mr. Oster, I'll try not to cry, but I first came to know of you last year, sitting up late one night, listening to the BBC. It was around the time of 9/11, I believe, the anniversary, and the hostess of the program had asked you what your view was of what had become of the country since 9/11. I think she expected a positive review, and I was so stunned and pleased by your very rational assessment that nothing had changed. And I appreciated that so greatly, because it feels like being in a desert. Everyone seems to have gone along with the narrative that things have changed and we're all more aware, etc., and we've used those horrific events to create something better in the world. And your interview stunned me, and
And obviously
I
touched you.
I can't say anything else.
And Linda, I appreciate your courage for calling in when you knew you were going to cry. Paul, do you remember the comment she's referring to?
I don't remember during the interview, but I'm sure she's remembering accurately, because this is how I do feel, that we haven't. I feel we're going backwards in this country.
In what
forward.
Respect?
Every respect. Pick a subject, and I'll give you my reasons why. Politically, it's been very depressing to have watched. And I even date it not to 9/11, but to the 2000 election, which I still feel very bitter about.
Bush versus Gore and the
Bush
way that turned
Gore.
Out.
Because Gore won, and it was stolen from him in a kind of legal coup by the Supreme Court. And I've never fully recovered, and I'm still shocked that America didn't rise up in some kind of disgust over what happened. But we just merrily went about our business, and here we are in much worse shape, I think, than we were in 2000.
Were you optimistic about the Obama era? Did you think he was going to be a philosopher king?
No, I was hopeful. I knew when I voted for him that he was a moderate. His politics are not the same as mine. I didn't quite understand the how rabid the Republicans would be in their opposition to him, and how persistently they would try to block every piece of legislation he's proposed. It's been, I think, the most divided country I've ever seen these last 4 years in my now long 65-year experience of being an American.
And you refer in your memoir to many issues that profoundly concerned you, but you also write that there are no good old days. What do you mean by that?
It means that we tend to get nostalgic about the past, and we think somehow that things are always getting worse. But when you look back very carefully at the then as opposed to the now, you realize that, no, things were pretty embattled then. Not everything was functioning well. I was born, as you said, in 1947, so this was the glorious post-war era that everyone thinks of as the greatest moment in American history, the 50s, Eisenhower, highways, television, money everywhere. Well, it was also a time of still rabid anti-Semitism in the United States, back alley abortions, the Red Scare, nuclear weapons, the arms race, and McCarthy, and not such a happy time in America, but we tend to gloss over those things. So my appeal is simply just try to remember accurately and how irritated you were back then.
I sometimes say the same thing about the media. People get nostalgia for the old days of the three television networks bringing everybody together. But there were only three voices in national broadcast news, and they were basically all the same three white men.
That's right, except when you had Huntley and Brinkley, so four.
Good point. Are you a fan of the internet era? Can you, somebody who writes long and thoughtful like you do, also tweet?
To tell you the truth, I write by hand. I've always written by hand in notebooks.
Really?
And then
Still,
and then I type up the work on an old manual typewriter. I've had a computer in the past, but I don't have a computer anymore. And I don't have a cell phone. And I'm the last surviving dinosaur, I suppose, who hasn't gone over into the digital world. I see my wife and my friends overwhelmed by email. All they do is complain about how difficult it is to keep up. And I figure if someone wants to get in touch with me, they'll if it's important enough to them, they'll figure out a way.
You're vice president of the Pan American Center. Do you see
Formerly.
Did you see that as a political freedom of speech mission?
Absolutely. I've been a member of Penn for something like 35 years, and it's the one organization, one human rights organization in the world that supports writers. And it's a very important thing that Penn is doing, trying to get imprisoned writers out of prison, censored writers out of their countries who are under threat. And I feel this is very important work. So I've been a devoted member and advocate of Penn's activities all these years.
We're running a little over, but let's take one more call. Denise in Manhattan.
Hello, Mr. Oster. I read The Book of Illusions years ago, and I absolutely was captivated by it. But that's not why I'm calling. I'm married to a Norwegian, and every year I go over to Norway.
Ah.
And my brother-in-law just loves your writing. And that's all I really have to say.
Well, I'm married to a Norwegian, too.
I know, and I've read The Sad American. Was that the name of
the Sorrows of an American.
Yeah,
by Siri Hustvedt.
Yes.
My brilliant wife. Yes.
So you're...
okay.
You are... Your books are, you know, really appreciated over in Norway among, you know, a certain group there.
Well, Denise, thank you.
My daughter, who is, of course, half Jewish and half Norwegian, has coined a new term, Jewegian. That's what she is.
Have you been translated into many languages?
44, 43, wow. Something like that.
And I don't know if you can judge this with respect to languages that you don't know, but can literature hold up when it's translated?
Some can and some can't. It depends on the nature of the writing itself. Some things are simply untranslatable, and other things can be very well translated. Think how impoverished our lives would be if we read only English language books. No Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, mm-hmm. No Dante, no Cervantes. We need translation. It's fundamental.
On the last page of the book, you write, quote, and this is in the second person, you ask yourself, how many mornings are left? Do you feel very aware of your mortality at 65?
Absolutely. Certainly, I have an ever-shrinking amount of time in front of me, and these are questions that are inevitable. It doesn't mean that this winter that I've entered into can't be a long winter. I'm hoping that it will be.
Does that awareness of your mortality affect your writing, your politics, your choices for how to spend your time, anything concrete?
That's a great question. I think the older I get, the more stubborn I am in not wanting to waste my time doing things that I have no interest in doing. For example, I don't like going to parties. And I just turn down invitations now. Things that maybe 20 years ago, out of some sense of duty or politeness I would have attended, now I just simply don't go.
The New York Times review of your last novel, Sunset Park, said one of your fixations is characters who, quote, mourn the passing moment even as they live in it, yearn to hold on to the present even as it slips away. Do you often feel that way?
Myself, no. But perhaps occasionally, but generally, no. I'm not mourning my life. I'm trying to live my life in the present.
And still living his life in the present.
Yep.
As his new memoir, Winter Journal, is published, the writer Paul Auster. Such a pleasure. Thank you very
Thanks for having me.
Really enjoyed the conversation. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.